I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Sometimes we say there are no words to describe something or someone. In the case of my guest today, there really are no words to describe the talent, the career, the woman that is Barbra Streisand.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
Streisand burst on the scene in 1964 with Funny Girl on Broadway. Right when it felt like the suburbs and McCarthyism might go on forever, the Beatles show up on the Ed Sullivan Show, and on Broadway, along comes this phenomenon, this totally new, unusually gorgeous, nakedly ambitious Jewish girl from Brooklyn in clothes so wildly bright they'd blow out your new color TV. She kept her name. She kept her nose. She kept that accent. She could not be more different from what WASP culture told women they should be.
New York is just full of unusual and interesting girls who are starting out in show business, but few of them have the style as early as this young lady. She's 19 years old. Her name is Barbra Streisand.
And then she gets on stage. She's grounded, she's powerful, and she's got the greatest voice America has ever heard. Over the following years, we also learn she's a great actress. Here she is trying to win Redford's love in The Way We Were.
Sure, I make waves. I mean, you have to, and I'll keep making them until you're every wonderful thing you should be and will be. You'll never find anyone as good for you as I am, to believe in you as much as I do or love you as much.
I know that.
Well, then why?
Streisand develops a reputation for being difficult and for being a bit of a recluse. She gets married, divorced, has a kid, but all the while she just keeps getting better and more famous until she's this unique character in American culture, a megastar on her own terms. I first met her in 1990 when she was getting ready to shoot The Prince of Tides. We've bonded over being New Yorkers in Hollywood, over food, over show business, and over our attention to detail.
You see, to work for somebody like you or me, you have to understand the artist's temperament. By the way, Stella, do me a favor. Take the clock and make sure it works, like it has needs batteries or wound or...
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You walk around the house and you have a... You're just making lists.
That just goes...
You're making lists.
How is this not taken care of? People don't see that the time is wrong?
It's this care, this focus on the little things that Barbra Streisand brings to her brilliant directing.
Well, that, yes, that, and also it was something that happened during The Way We Were, where two scenes were cut out that were intrinsic to the value of the story. And it made me so crazy that they couldn't see that.
That propelled you into it.
That propelled me into it. I couldn't understand it. And it's hard to quarrel with a hit movie. I don't know if it was a hit at the time, tell you the truth. It's grown to
be a hit.
Let's
say it was.
I don't know.
Warren Beatty said to me once, he said, until you take ultimate responsibility and you're willing to direct the movie, you're going to be constantly frustrated. He said, you must consider that if you don't have
it. It was so delicious. And it's like, you know, when you finally have the power to control your work, you get very humble in a sense. It's like I wanted to give power away to other people as well. You know, I would say to my stand-in, you run that course with the cameraman. This is the shot, but I want you to be able to tell me where to stand. In other words, it's a feeling of such gratitude where you never have to raise your voice because everybody's finally listening. You don't have to get angry about anything.
They weren't listening before, sometimes?
Well, sometimes when I would say things as just an actress, like this is what I'm telling you, this story of The Way We Were, it went on deaf ears. You know, they didn't agree with me, whatever. But when you see something so clearly that's wrong to me, or what could be right, or see, I had such a great time directing Yentl because I did it in England and in Czechoslovakia. In England, they're not afraid of women, powerful women, strong women, because they had a queen, they have a queen, and at the time they had the prime minister, who was Margaret Thatcher. So I was shocked at the respect that I had as a first-time director. Couldn't believe it. And the crew was so kind, and just it was the most wonderful experience, I must say. And even the Czechoslovakian government was wonderful to me, because I needed Jews to be in the synagogue and pray and so forth. And, you know, it was during communist times. And they went to the Jewish community, thank God, and had them come. So I didn't have to teach them how to be Jewish, you know, how to pray.
They got you some real Jews.
Real Jews.
Yeah. It wasn't Italians dressed as Jews, like in New York.
Where they have to say, well, how do you stand in a synagogue and how do you pray? And it was wonderful. And also, well, you know, when you have extras in Czechoslovakia then, they didn't give them lunch. So the people would come with like bags of their lunch, which broke my heart. So I would, you know, give them our food, which we never had vegetables. We had to send to London or France or Italy to get vegetables because, you know, their food diet was like hot chocolate. I loved it, of course, bread and butter and hot chocolate in the morning with whipped cream on it.
Those are my kids.
Yes. I was in heaven. And I wanted to be thinner, but, well, and every day I would, not every day, but every few days, I would bring in pasties, you know, with that delicious dough and the meat inside. And we'd always have the most delicious teas, and I'd bring in those cream like donuts shaped like a hot dog from Wimpy's, and, you know, eat this delicious cream with the donuts. Oh, my God. It was so good.
You had a good time.
And it was very sweet because the whole crew wrote a letter. That's one of my prized possessions, I must say. And they wrote this letter to the newspapers. And it said that, you know, Miss Streisand, something like Miss Streisand never raises her voice and has a smile for us every day, and it's like not the stories we've heard about her, and no newspaper would publish it. But it figures. It's like Hillary Clinton.
As you said, the upside of that experience with Yentl was working in a culture where the power of women was just accepted. And I'm crestfallen, to say the least, about what happened here, not just because this guy won, but I really do think misogyny and
well, the rejection of women in power. Well, in 1984, I did get some sort of award from Women in Film, directing Yentl, and a lot of my speech was about women against women. Because the reviews of Yentl from women were vicious. You know, in other words, they didn't even talk about this celebration of womanhood, that a woman could not only, you know, make dinner and have babies, but she could have an intellect. She could want to study, be something more
than... Do what men do.
Huh?
Do what men do.
Do what men do, just equality, you know? So to read a review that said she wore a designer yarmulke. Now everything, every piece of clothing in that movie was authentic. Same year, there was the film directed by Ingmar Bergman, Fanny and Alexander. They wore the same yarmulke, but nobody attacked that film. I love detail. So I would, you know, for years I would do research about Polish Jews, about these Jews, that Jews, everything, the YIVO Institute in New York, talking to scholars, studying Talmud, just to bring that, because I do believe that when you study like that and do the research, you don't have to act that. It's like the camera picks up the truth, even just behind your eyes, in the sound of your voice, whatever it is. Mine, you know, I had this wonderful shot, I thought, because it cuts from a chicken coop to me sitting behind the bars up, separated from the men in a shul. And that shot was attacked by this woman critic. Janet Maslin, her name was. Now, she could attack my lip sync, because that's true. I'm a terrible lip syncer. I can't do it because when I did movies like Funny Girl or Hello, Dolly, you know, they record the soundtrack 3 months before you shoot. And I have to be in the moment as an actor. I don't know how I'm going to feel when I actually perform it. So that's why when I did the movie Star is Born, it's all real. It's all, I had a
You didn't
truck.
Want to replicate.
I did not want, I needed to be free to be in the moment. So we recorded on the spot. What do you call that? Live. It was all live. And then what I would do is, because I had Final Cut on that movie, I could control those things. We would shoot the close-ups first, so where the performance really counted. And then I would just choose it right on the spot. Okay, I think, and I would do about 1 to 4 takes. You know, all these stories about me, like I do right. Millions of takes, most of them are false. And so let's say I would take 3, you know, and then move the cameras back to do the wider shots.
And match to that
and match
take.
It because you didn't have to see me close, you know, not doing the lip sync good.
I did a documentary film about Cannes. It's ostensibly about Cannes. And Ryan Gosling, yeah. We corner him at a
yeah.
hotel
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I think I saw it, yeah.
And Jimmy Toback and I did this thing called Seduced and Abandoned. And we get Gosling at the Beverly Hills Hotel, or the Bel Air Hotel, I should say. Anyway, long story short is he has this beautiful explication of how agonizing it is to shoot films and just in that kind of Arthur Murray by numbers way we have to shoot a match to this and match to this.
Yeah.
It can't be fresh and it's painful.
No, and that's why I love long takes because I think I'm from the theater and we had to do a whole show, right? So I don't like pieces. I mean, the fun of directing to me is designing the shot, the camera, accommodating the actors. So the actors, there's a lot of scenes in Yentl that you can see like this. They're all in one move, practically. In other words, we come in through a door, and I'm in the foreground, let's say, but he who's following me, my lead actor, who was Mandy Patinkin at the time, and he still is, but you know, we see him standing there, and then he comes forward, and I sit down. He's standing up, but the camera never moved. But you see everything. Then the camera moves as we're together, but it doesn't cut. And then he has, you know, when he leaves me, you see him go out the door. He slams the door, and the camera moves in a little bit as I'm thinking about it. That's the scene. But it's all, what's fun about that is that we're all on our toes. You can't make a mistake. In most of these shots that I do that, there's no coverage.
Woody.
Huh?
Like Woody and Scorsese, the greatest films, there's very little coverage. The actors play the scene in the frame. They
really
play it.
That's right.
Now, in the time that you made films, the many years you've made films, the successful acting and not directing, successful as a director and producer and all those things, were there people that you wanted to work with? Were there people you sat there and said, God, I'd love to make a film with that person? Because you've been in such a privileged place and had all these people available to you. Was there a director that you dreamed of working with that you didn't get to work with?
Well, Ingmar Bergman is a person that contacted me to do a remake of The Merry Widow. And I was so excited, you know, and I came to Sweden, and we embraced, and it was this wonderful embrace, you know. I mean, I can't explain what that's like. It was just, he sort of understood me, and I understood him without any words. And the first act of that screenplay was fantastic. I mean, very bawdy. Kind of shocking. I loved it, you know. So I have letters now. I forget things until I have to go into my archives and look at this stuff. Letters from him and notes that I wrote back to him talking about this film.
And what happened?
The second act, you know, he says, we're going to be collaborators. And the second act was not very good, I thought. It was like, did you ever see Amadeus? I'm sure you did.
Sure.
The first act was extraordinary to me in the movie, and the second act was, I don't know, just somehow repetitious. It didn't go far enough in the story, you know? And that's the way I felt about this. And all of a sudden, it was gone. The collaboration was over. We never made the film. And I couldn't quite believe it. I mean, the fact that I didn't like certain things in the second act.
That he liked.
Well, he never defended it. It was like, you don't think that's right. And so, but I would have loved to work with Bertolucci and Scorsese. You know what I did? I realize this now in looking back at my life. I turned down Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I turned down a lot of films, actually. Because
sure.
I was lazy. I'm basically, I'm a dichotomy here. A dichotomy. Lazy and, I don't know what the word is.
Restless.
Restless, maybe, yeah. Like wanting to create.
If and we did a soap about you, it would be called The Lazy and the Restless.
But what anyway, do you have?
I'm joking.
Oh, no, that's a
Rather
very good
than the
title.
The Lazy and the Restless would be your daytime
yeah,
drama.
Exactly. I love to take a vacation and do nothing. I like to have no appointments.
I think that's a condition in my mind of people who have tremendous, not so much financial success, but creative success. I mean, there's a famous actress who I won't name.
Wait, you know what? Do you want to take a sip of soup on your...
Bring her a soup.
Do you want soup too?
I'll have a soup.
I mean, we
who
can...
Who am I to say no?
Well, I mean, this is a
I'm
podcast,
Irish. It's bad
right?
luck to say no to soup.
Is that right?
In Ireland.
Oh, dear.
I just made that up.
Oh, just put that over here. Oh, see, I just brought this table from the back.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And we need another table maybe of yours.
Sure.
Because this is miso soup.
Don't worry about me. I'm great.
I mean, in other words, people know we eat.
Right.
Right? So if they hear a sound, it's okay? Good. Because I always like to eat.
Cut out the eating.
Oh, really? No, you won't. Mmm. That is delicious, isn't it? And healthy. What were we talking about?
Restless and lazy. When I would talk to McCartney about the Beatles, he'd say to me, it was hard work. Later on, when they gain creative control of their material, and it's like anybody, then they take a year to do another album. But in the beginning, they really worked like dogs, you know?
I think you're right.
And for you, I'm wondering, in the beginning, when you do Broadway, are you out there and you're just so pumped and excited and you're young and everyone's glorifying you and loving what you're putting out there and you really love it, or you're sitting there going, I don't want to do this show 8 times a week. Like, what happened to you in the beginning? Were you excited and game?
In the beginning, I wanted to prove myself.
Right.
I wanted to prove to my mother that I could be a success.
Right.
You know, it comes from that. It's like really deep. It's deep and quiet. It's not loud, by the way. It's not what makes Sammy run. It's quiet. It really is. But again, you can feel that passion. You can feel that need to be seen somehow. Because I wasn't seen much by my
mother.
I lost my father.
How old were you when your dad passed away?
15 months. But my mother said that after he died, I would climb up on the window waiting for him to come home. Because I used to do that, I guess, as a baby and wait for him and he would come home. And in a sense, I've idolized my father because he was a PhD. He was a teacher, which I so respect, teachers. And he wrote poems, and he was artistic. And he was an athlete as well as a debater, you know. And he was in part of French dramatics and English literature. And I didn't read his thesis till many years later, because as an actress, when I was 16, I was fascinated by Eleonora Duse and Sarah Bernhardt, wanting to be an actress. And my father's books were tied up in the basement of our Brooklyn apartment. Mark Twain, Charles Dickens, all the great novels. I read, Nancy Drew mysteries. I read movie magazines, you know, and dreamed that someday maybe I could be famous.
Did you have that dream then when you were young?
Oh, yeah. I would have my pint of coffee, ice cream, Breyers, and sit in my bed and dream. Go to the movies sometimes on a Saturday afternoon, the Lois Kings, where they had the greatest ice cream. And we also... Well, yeah.
No, you're like me. Somebody will say, what was the best part of the summer? I'd say, well, there's this restaurant that has the mm-hmm. best coffee ice cream with chocolate-covered hazelnuts in it.
Mm-hmm.
But watching who in the, on screen, if to the extent you want to say or recall, somebody you'd watch movies and go, yeah, that's it. I'm going to do something like that. Not Doris Day. I mean, who
was
somebody?
No, it was, well, I loved Marjorie Morningstar because I knew the summer places in where I was sent to camp in the Catskills, or my mother and stepfather, when they came to visit me, I didn't know my mother was married. And I said, I'm going home from here.
What do you mean you didn't know your mother got married?
She never told me.
So he was a boyfriend for a while?
I guess.
He was around?
No, I never met him before. But when I insisted, see, I was a strong kid. So my mother came to visit me with this stranger, and I said, I'm going home. I'm not staying here another day longer. So we have to pack me up. I think I was 7 and a half, maybe.
So for a long time of your youth, you were raised by him. He was on the scene.
Oh, yeah.
When you go home, then he's in your life.
He's in my life, this stranger.
How did he handle you?
Didn't like me.
He didn't like you. Why?
Because
you weren't quiet? Because you had an opinion?
That's exactly right.
Was the connection with him such as it was? Because the connection with your mother also was a bit thinner than you might have liked compared to your feelings for your father. I grew up in a house where my dad was my idol. Mm. I idolized my dad. And my mom, my older sister and I, we were her lieutenants. Chores. Mm-hmm. And your mom didn't push him or cajole him or try to get him to...
Never.
Your relationship with your mom was a little less than it was your feeling toward your father.
Well...
Or were you head over heels in love with your mother?
No. I felt that she didn't know me. She didn't know.
But could she? I don't think my mother knows me either, but I've seen now in my life, she couldn't. She wasn't capable. My mother never said to me, my mother's alive, and I wrote this in my book, she never once said to me, what's it like to be you? When you get up there and do that, mm-hmm. what do you enjoy? But to understand me, and I'm her son. I'm her oldest son. And where was the conversation about what I go through in my life and my career? My mother never...
Nothing about that. My mother's love was shown through food. She would bring me, when I was a young actress, you know, and I moved away from home when I was 16 from Brooklyn to New York, got an apartment right next
16.
To my...
16?
16. I graduated high school at 16.
Erasmus,
yeah. I graduated in 3.5 years. So I doubled my science and math, which I loved. I loved those subjects.
Because you were desperate to get out of Brooklyn?
I was desperate to be an actress, to get away from real life.
Not a singer, an actress.
An actress, oh yeah. And my singing was when I was 5 and 6 and 7. On the stoop in Brooklyn with the girls, you know, singing and harmonizing. That was my singing. But my love was wanting to be an actress. And so that's when I went to the library, the 42nd Street Library, and read the plays of these great actresses, you know. And I wanted to be a classical actress. So part of me still feels like a failure. You know, when I wanted to play, after I was well known, I wanted to play the two Cleopatras, the one... Caesar and Cleopatra, and
Antony and Cleopatra,
right? So one is a child, 14 years old, who I thought it should be Orson Welles or Marlon Brando, fat, you know, and then I would be even littler.
Well-fed, let's say.
Well-fed, yes. And hiding, you know, from this man, and then play the woman, Cleopatra. And the television stations, I wanted to do it on TV. They said, well, is it going to be a musical? I mean, you're going to add music? It's like they can't see that you could do both? I mean, though, you have to do the music with the, you know, absolutely awful feeling. I wanted to play Romeo and Juliet, and I got to do it finally for Lee Strasberg at the studio. And it's one of my, I can't find the letter that they wrote me to. Well, that's a whole long story, but.
To invite you to join the studio?
Yeah, but when I first auditioned for the studio, I was 15, and I was doing it with another guy who asked me to just be in it, but they wrote me a letter to say, do your own audition. And then when I did, they found out I was 15, and they said, come back when you're, you know, 18. It's probably a nice way of saying no, but so that's why it was terrible. When I was in on Broadway, I wrote on my playbill, I am not a member of the Actors Studio, because all the actors who were would say a member of the Actors Studio, right. And I was pissed off at right. them, you know. But that was interesting. I did some of my best work then when I was 15 and 16. I played Medea, you know, and did that great aria after she killed her kids. And, you know, she says a line like, you know, something about this wound in the middle of myself. What a brilliant line. I mean, I am a woman, you know, with this wound in the middle of myself. I was good then.
And so you're saying this wound in the middle of myself at the Actors Studio.
No, that was for, just I did it in class, that scene from Medea.
Where was your class?
You know what I would do then? I would, I had another name. So I didn't want to miss anything. So I went to two different acting classes and gave a different name in one. And then I used to make money, you get $4.05 it was, to be an usher in the theater. So I would love to go see the plays. But in a sense, I didn't have enough money to see all the plays. So I became an usher in the theater so I could see the play. But meanwhile, I was 16, 17, that kind of age. I knew that I would be famous, because I would hide my head so they wouldn't see me, my face, showing them to their seats, because I thought, you know, when I become famous, they're going to recognize me as the girl who showed them to their seats. So how do you figure that? That's something I can't explain.
You really, there's a part of you that knew you yeah. would end up doing what you did?
Mm-hmm.
To me,
And my mother didn't believe in me. She kept telling me, do what your father did, become a teacher, you get time off, for you get vacations, free vacations, summers
off.
Snap
out of it.
Yeah, learn to type. And that's when I let my nails grow long, so I couldn't type. Believe me, I wish I could type now. I have to dictate everything into a
All those things I wish I'd learned. French, typing, yeah, cooking.
That's right.
No, but with your mother, did yeah. she eventually come around? I mean, how could she not come around with everything you've done?
I think I was really just trying to prove to her that I could be famous. By the way, as soon as I became famous, I didn't like it. I don't like fame. I don't like stardom. I only like the work, the creative work. That's all I like.
Lascia che io pianga la cruda sorte.
That's Streisand singing Lascia che io pianga, normally more the domain of the world's great opera singers like Renee Fleming. Fleming told me that she tried and struck out on two other genres before she landed on opera.
Had I grown up in New York City, the singer-songwriter thing might have opened, doors might have opened. I mean, I sang on television in high school, winning some talent show, playing a song that I wrote. Then I tried to pursue jazz then, and that didn't work. Despite the fact that Eastman had a phenomenal jazz department, I just couldn't get in.
She's about to mix it up again. Her Broadway debut is set for next spring in a revival of Carousel. Take a listen to the rest of Renee Fleming's story on heresthething.org. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. With no formal voice training and no money to kickstart a career, Streisand relied on raw talent to build herself up and the wiles of a man who happened to hear her at a small Greenwich Village club called the Bonsoir. Marty Ehrlichman was a music manager and almost as young and hungry as Barbara herself. He used his slim Rolodex and razor-sharp PR instincts to help build Barbara's image into what it is today.
I met Marty at the Bonsoir when he came one night. I was 19, and he saw me as the first act, the opening act, and said, if you ever need me, kid. I was kept over at the Bonsoir many times, but then I couldn't get a job. Finally, I got a job, and they were paying me something like $75 a week or $100 a week, $100 a week. But I could eat, you know. So if people wanted me to sit down, I would order a baked potato, sour cream and chives, and butter. So, but I couldn't make a living. I really needed more. So I called Marty and I said, you know, is there any way you could get me $150 a week? Marty told me many years later that he actually paid the $50 because they wouldn't go for the raise.
He loved
it. That's why he's such a great person. Great soul.
He invested
soul.
In you.
He invested in me, yeah.
You've been with him now for how long? It's like...
Well, we separated for a while, for a few years.
Why?
He didn't get along with the man in my life at the time was John Peters.
I've heard this story before.
Yeah, something like that. But then, believe me, we got back as soon as I could. So that period is over 50 years. But if you... take out the...
What does he do for you now? What does he provide
Marty?
For you? And what does he provide for you now? You trust him?
Everything.
What?
He reads scripts, you know, and he's my full-on manager. Today is his birthday, by the way. He's 88 years old.
Happy birthday, Marty Ehrlichman.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching these, you know, not just old Cavett shows where famous actors would come on. Is it a spring roll? Is it meat?
I think this one is vegetarian. Or are you a vegetarian?
Well, I don't eat beef.
Is there eat the light one? Yeah, I think it's chicken. Is it? Isn't that good? Mm, yeah.
I remember I was sitting in your apartment years ago.
I get very hungry when I work.
And Sis Corman was there.
Oh God, yeah.
And you were going to do Prince of Tides, and mm-hmm. I came to meet with you.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
To do
I
the movie, The Prince of Tides, and you're. Woman who took care of your apartment came in, and you said, yeah, I'll eat a little something. I could eat a little something. And she would bring us some crudité or crackers or whatever, some spreads. And you looked at me and you said, oh, God, I got to, you know, I'm going to get ready to do a movie, and I love to eat. And I said to you, I go, if we do this movie together, I'm going to hire us a chef. I'll pay for it. And this chef will come down, and we're going to eat whatever the fuck we want to eat.
That's why I loved you, see?
And you looked, I'll never forget, you looked at me and you were like, wow.
We could be friends.
I go, let's just forget about, you know, driving ourselves crazy with all this. Let's go down and make the movie. Have a good, if we feel like eating, we eat. If we don't feel like eating, we don't eat. We don't have to go crazy.
Oh, what a great idea.
And then you cast, what's his name? In the movie.
Nick.
I'm kidding, I'm teasing.
Yes, because he had to be a white-looking southerner. You know what I mean? You're very New York.
I love that movie.
Did you? Oh, good.
Now, watching those old, you know, Cavett's and On Comes Brando and On Comes This One and That One from that generation of Belafonte when he was mm-hmm, young and all mm-hmm, that civil rights mm-hmm. activism, were you active then as well?
Oh, yeah. I was supporting Bella Abzug for Congress in like 1970. I even supported Mayor Lindsay, who was a Republican, because I liked him. I liked the way he spoke. You know, I thought...
He was a leader.
He was a leader, and he was fair, and he was believed in justice, and just liked him. He was also adorable looking. So, you know, it's like... You know what happened when I sang in Houston, by the way, before the storm? I invited the Bushes, President H.W. Bush, I mean, 41, and Barbara Bush to come to my concert, and they came. And I gave him socks because I heard he collects socks, and they came backstage, and she brought me a pin, and I gave her something, and they were just so lovely. Even now, I wrote them to see if they were okay. How's their house? And they said, we're fine. We're in Maine and this and that, you know. In other words, you know, he had dignity. He had great dignity. And she was an advocate for women's rights. I like good people. That's why I can't quite understand what's happened to this country. And it goes back to women, too, women against women. Yesterday, I was watching Hillary being interviewed by somebody, and the first question was so rude by the woman. Well, how do you know that the Democrats even want you around? When she was running, there were three women who interviewed her as well, and they were so, the faces scrunched up, you know, on television going, well, so are you trustworthy or are you not trustworthy? I mean, they would like shockingly rude attitudes. And I told her chief of staff, you know, I think you should be interviewed by men. They're going to be nicer to her than the women. 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Now, how do you figure that? I saw her on The View this morning, and I think I would have said, if he was in my space like that, I don't think you have to call him a creep, but you could say, you know, you're going to get your own time. They're going to ask you a question, and would you like me to stand behind you in the shot? I don't think so. Yeah. So if you don't mind, can you
I always say to myself, if she did that to him, I use that phrase and append it to a lot of things. If she had done that to him, if she had said that about him.
Right.
So you sing at Clinton's inauguration. You're close to Clinton, the old Clinton years in the 90s.
They were great.
And they were great.
God,
and I have my criticisms of Clinton. I have my criticisms of him and his policy.
But what did you criticize about his policy?
Well, I just think peace is a quaint idea now. You never hear these people running for office talk about peace and a policy and a strategy to get us to peace. We're in a state of perpetual war. Mm-hmm. We spend trillions of dollars, and I mean trillions with a T, that we don't have. I make it very simple for myself. Mm-hmm. I read, I have a copy, I carry it around in a folder of my favorite writings that I have. And one of them is Eisenhower's farewell address and coining the phrase the military-industrial complex.
Send it to me.
And when he says, you know, every missile that is fired, we lose this. And every bomb that we drop, we cost us this. And he refers to this world in arms, Eisenhower. So, you know, Eisenhower, the last man to be elected president by acclamation, a man who did not want the job. Mm. And everyone around him said, you won World War II. You got to run for this job. You got to do this. Mm-hmm. And Eisenhower, the hood ornament of the American military machine, walks out the door and says, watch out for these people. He warned about the military-industrial. He coined the phrase the military-industrial complex.
Right.
And he's basically saying, watch out for these people.
They make money from war.
They have too much power. And we've lived, and it keeps getting progressively worse and worse and worse, where, and I don't think Clinton was, but Hillary Clinton voted for the war in Iraq. That
it was the
me.
One thing that really upset me.
That was almost a deal breaker for me. Almost.
Yeah.
You know?
But you have to remember this, because I've discussed this with her and President Clinton. She at the time thought that Bush would keep his word, Bush 43. Mm. And they were supposed to go to the UN. They were supposed to have weapons inspectors make sure that there was, you know, nothing there. That wasn't done. We had weapons inspectors because I used to talk to Scott Ritter, who was a weapons inspector there for 7 years. And he said, there are no weapons left. And if there were any chemical weapons, they have a shelf life. They don't work. That's what we saw. But they weren't even allowed to even complete anything. They certainly never went to the UN. And all of a sudden, you know, we're in a war.
Without picking someone in a current menu of candidates, I mean, there are two women that come to mind, Kamala Harris here from California, where a lot of people are talking about her and how gleaming she seems right now as a candidate, and of course Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. But without picking anybody individually, what do you think we need to run in 2020 to beat Trump? What kind of person do you think it's going to take? Forget about man or woman. It's going to be a person who does what or who says what.
Who says the truth. Truth is everything. I mean, that's what kills me. I love the truth. I love the power of the truth. You have to believe that person, and you have to believe they stand for what American values are supposed to mean, not like in the Newt Gingrich way of whatever that is, American values, but to be for justice, to be for diversity, to be respectful.
To accept change.
Yeah.
To accept change that in New York, I'll never forget the Daily News. I mean, yes, this is a fact, I suppose. When the census came out in 2010 or 2000, you know, every 10 years, the Daily News put on the cover that white New Yorkers were now the plurality, that they were under 50%, that the city had now become 51%, literally, black, Asian, Hispanic, so forth, that white New Yorkers in all five boroughs represented less than 50%. And I thought, well, that may be true, but what are you promoting when you write that? And that's going to happen in this country. White privilege, as we understand it, and white people, I'm not saying we're going to become Rhodesia, but it's I think that people who accept change, what choice do you have but to accept change? That this world we live in is going to become more and more diverse, you know, in terms of people's sexual identity and women in power and things like that. And I find that the Democrats, I mean, I'm very critical of them as well. The Democrats will say almost anything to get elected.
I don't think so.
Well,
I think the Democrats...
I think the Republicans will say anything to get elected. There's a difference. The Democrats, almost anything, and the Republicans will say anything.
The Democrats are too nice. That's what I find.
So?
Yeah, they don't...
I always wanted to run because I'm not very nice, and I wanted to be the...
You'd probably be a hit.
I wanted to be the more two-fisted Democrat.
That's what it should be. You have to say it like it is.
I'm going to be the tougher Democrat.
You have to be tough. That's actually what I said when I first met Obama. I said, we did a fundraiser for him, and it raised $11 million that night. And I sat with him, and I said, are you tough enough? That was my first question to him. Of course I'm tough, you know? But, I mean, this is a terrible thing to say, but, okay, and I know it can't be done. But when Russia was suspected of invading our democracy, I thought to myself, why aren't they postponing the election? How do you have an election now when Russia is hacking us?
And don't we do it over?
Huh?
And don't we do it over?
Yeah, right. That's what I thought.
How is this valid?
And whenever I've said it to anybody, they go, you can't do that. Why not?
Right.
This
it is weird.
Huh?
It is weird to sit there and say the result of the election is entirely false, but let it stand. Because to change it would be really, the country couldn't handle it.
No, I mean, look at the difference. I'm going to write an article, actually, about this next week, about the difference in America.
Right.
Yeah, the difference in America, what it would be like if Hillary were president. Do you realize that women and girls could hold their head up high? She and Angela Merkel would be running the free world. Did you see the woman, you know, Wonder Woman movie?
Mm.
It was fantastic because women were in charge. Women are nurturing, and women can be tough and make decisions that are based on compassion and wisdom. You know, even in the Jewish religion, women, the Orthodox Jewish religion, which I am not, but men have to say certain prayers every day, but women have to say less prayers because they are closer to God, because they are creative. They birth babies. They feed those babies. They nurture them afterwards.
And that makes them different.
It does.
My wife reminds me of that every day, actually.
Well, that's good.
How different women are from men.
Remember
how more
this.
Sainted women are than men.
No, but it is true. But I think what we're missing with Trump is compassion, kindness, respect.
Well, I like what you said.
Integrity.
We're missing honesty.
Huh?
What I like, as you said, is that we're missing honesty, and honesty is everything.
Honesty,
if we just be honest, we'll get through everything.
We can't understand the news. It was like he was a farce. He was a disrespectful womanizer.
I'm still in shock.
Huh?
I'm still in shock.
But don't you see stress? Stress is causing me to eat, you know, more than I usually
do. As soon as I leave here, I'm going to go pull on the side of the road and go eat something.
Get a hot dog.
I'm going to
get
something. Grilled cheese sandwich or something.
A grilled cheese.
Yeah,
wouldn't that be great?
Cheese.
Yeah. It's, you know, I found out that when you're stressed, you cortisol levels raise
yes.
in you. And cortisol makes you gain weight.
Yes. I know all these things.
I was away with some friends for a week. I didn't read a book. I played games, which I play to fall asleep at night because I'm after looking at TV and reading the news, I can't fall asleep. So I have to play backgammon, you know, and gin. So, I mean, it was such an interesting thing for you who's an eater too. Every day we had bread and butter, you know. Every day we ate pasta in Italy. Every day we had desserts with sugar. We gained nothing. Maybe 2 ounces, 3 ounces. Out. We just let it go.
Not having to wallow in them. I'll never forget Kathleen Turner. She said this on this show. She was one of my first guests. Mm-hmm. And I said to you, you were married to your husband, Jay. You got divorced. She said, you never got married again. I said, do you miss that? Do you want to be with somebody? And she said, Alec, I put the key in the door of my apartment. And the thing that makes me most happy is I know that there's nobody on the other side of that door.
Wow.
I walk in, I can do whatever I want to do. I don't have to ask anybody's permission or blah, blah, blah. I mean, she really was like happy to be single. And you don't like to be single.
No.
You don't.
But I was for a long time. But no, I like looking forward to my husband coming home and, you know, waiting for him to, so we could eat together. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And he enjoys food too. I mean, we just take trips up to Santa Barbara just to get an ice cream cone from McConnell's. My favorite flavor, Brazilian coffee, which they don't sell in pints in the market. You have to go there or, like now I can't have it in my freezer because I'll eat the whole pint. Oh. I just start with a little and a cone. Just, you know, while it's melting around the edges and
sure.
I'll just eat that part and just, no, it's gone.
To me, there's that familiar sound. I'd be watching the news and it's like 10 o'clock at night. I'd be eating a mm-hmm. late night pint of ice cream. And then all of a sudden I'd hear that unmistakable sound of the spoon scraping the bottom of the cake. I go, oh my God, how did that happen?
But how come you're thin? How did you lose weight?
I started losing sugar. Sugar was my nemesis.
Just took away sugar?
I'm pre-diabetic and my numbers were tragic. And they said to me, you're going to start shooting.
What were your numbers?
Over 300.
And
they
said
you're going to start having to shoot insulin if you don't get with this.
Yeah.
So I still do bad things every now and then, but nowhere near. I mean, I was somebody that ate. I was truly, I can say this without hesitation, I was an ice cream addict.
Mm.
You know, graters, having graters ice cream shipped to me.
But you have to, look, one day when you're cheating, you have to try McConnell's. Do you like coffee ice cream or vanilla?
Of course, I crave coffee ice cream.
Okay,
love
it's
it.
The greatest.
I can't get
Brazilian
enough of it.
Coffee. They were so sweet, McConnell's, because when I did my last movie with Seth Rogen, I had to eat ice cream. So I said, I have to have the ice cream from Santa Barbara. But I had them try something that Will Wrights used to do that went out of business. They had chocolate-covered almonds in the coffee ice cream. So I asked them to make that flavor.
But now
people develop nut allergies, so they hardly put nuts.
Do you have nut allergies?
No, I don't.
What do we care about people with nut allergies? We don't have it.
No, we do care about them, but now I just read they discovered a drug that will take away nut allergies. Do you ever read the magazine called The Week? I love The Week.
Yeah.
And I read an article in there that talked about there's a drug now to take away nut allergies.
My last question for you is before I get into trouble, because I want to take you to dinner and have that McConnell's waiting for you when I come back.
Right now.
I will. And that is, when you sing, you know, people hear your voice and that melts them. It really gets to them. You know, you're the greatest female vocalist of all time.
Oh, you're so sweet. I don't know.
There's other women
that
who I love. Mm-hmm. I'm not dismissing them, but you're the greatest female vocalist ever.
What a compliment.
And when you go into the studio, when you go to record, I'm assuming there's a passion, there's a connection, there's a soul.
I love recording because it's private. And there, it's just me and the music. You know, I could look like crap. I don't have to dress up. I don't have to put makeup on. And it's just the sound and the musicians, the instruments and what I can hear and say, oh, I could hear a string line here with a sound, and I don't read music, but I'll have to go, you know, it's that note. What is it? I don't know. But it's that chord, you know. I mean, it's just, that's fun for me.
Does that singing make you happy, that you can do that?
Yeah.
It does.
I can hear things that I thought, oh, shoot, I should have done that over. Or, is that the right take? I mean, whatever. But no, I liked when we put out a new album and Sirius Radio plays my songs 24 hours a day and I happen to have the radio on. I think that was good.
I want to say I love you.
I love you too.
And you're the greatest. You're the greatest.
The more I live, the more I learn. The more I learn, the more I realize. The less I know. Each step I take, Papa, I've a voice now. Each page I turn, Papa, I've a choice now. Each mile I travel only means the more I have to go. What's wrong with wanting more? If you can fly, then soar. With all there is, why settle for just a piece?
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.